Most students of broadcasting learn about its past from a 3-volume history written by Eric Barno. He also edited the International Encyclopedia of Communications and founded the Radio Television Film Department at Columbia University. Now he's written a memoir called Media Marathon. Barno, who also wrote and produced for radio and TV, was born before the days of broadcasting in 1908. We asked him to remember his first radio job in 1931. He was hired by an advertising agency to produce a network radio show sponsored by the agency's client, Camel Cigarettes. The show was called The Camel Quarter Hour, and it was broadcast on the CBS radio network at 7:45 Eastern Time, 6 nights a week.
It was a 15-minute show, and it began with Morton Downey singing Carolina Moon, Keep Shining, Shining on the One That Waits for Me. And that faded down, and then there was an announcement that this was the Camel Quarter Hour. And he was identified somewhere as the Camel Minstrel. And then he sang another number, and then that was followed by the essential part of the program, which was Tony Wands, who had developed an enormous audience reading poems at 9 in the morning. And he became a kind of soulmate to millions of women. They wrote him letters and so on. And the whole idea of the program was, if we can get Tony against the same kind of lush music to do a commercial about Camel cigarettes, it'll bring a lot of women into the fold. So this was our idea, to double the market by getting women to smoke.
Do you remember what the songs to advertise Camel were like? Did he sing jingles, or were they more like romantic ballads about smoking cigarettes?
Well, first of all, it was sweet music. And then Tony Wands always began his programs with, "Are you listening?" He spoke very quietly, very close to the microphone. And he would read a poem in the middle of the program, and then at the beginning and the end, over the same kind of music, he would say things like this, that cigarettes, they're as fresh as the dew that dawn spills on a field of clover. And, the language is all like that. And they had just come out with a cellophane-wrapped package, which ensured freshness. And at that time, Lucky Strike had a program in which the commercials were delivered by somebody who was referred to as Thundering Thorgenson. He shouted at you. And this was thought to be a good strategy against Thundering Thorgenson, which was whispering Tony Wands.
When you started working in radio, what did you like most about radio, and what did you think was the most unsatisfactory part about it? In other words, what were some of the best and worst programs that you remember?
I remember, the only thing I remember is that I did not own a radio, and I had never thought of buying one. And after I was hired, I went and bought one and listened to it all weekend so that I could come in on Monday morning full of ideas. And so I had no worst or best programs in mind. I just didn't listen to radio at all.
What did you think of it when you started listening?
I was intrigued and amazed by it. The agency representative took me around to various programs that they represented. So the very first program that I saw then, and I didn't criticize it as something absurd, but it was Les Rees and Artie Dunn, two people who sang Cheek by Jowl at a piano in close harmony. And their program began, the Chiclet song, when you're feeling kind of blue and you wonder what to do, chew chiclets and cheer up. When you've lost your appetite, here's the way to set it right. Chew chiclets and cheer up. There's a sweet and minty flavor in each handy yellow box. And at that point, it would fade down for an announcer who would step in and say something else, and then they would introduce the songs. And that was the way that program went. And that was one of our programs. Now, I never was given the job of looking after that. But the next program that I visited was Evangeline Adams, who was the great astrologer of the period. And she had a program sponsored by Four Hands Toothpaste. And the whole idea was that you could send in the carton, the flap, or the part of the carton of Four Hands Toothpaste to her with the date of an hour of your birth, and she would send you
astrological reading?
Yes, an astrological reading, telling you particularly what constellations and stellar arrangements you ought to be on guard against in the next few months, what your great opportunities were, etc.
In the early days of radio, was absolutely everything scripted? Say you and I were having a little interview in the early 1930s, would our lines be written for us?
No, but this is what would happen. And I was asked to, I was interviewed over NBC at this time, and I've forgotten the lady who interviewed me, but the procedure was that the interview was done away from the studio, and a transcript was made, and then the whole thing was written. You could not broadcast an interview live. That was the whole idea. And then we would get a script, and it would be edited for policy, see if there's anything wrong anybody had said that was terrible and frightening. And so they would edit it down, and then we came into the studio and we read our interview. And that's the way all interviews were done up to a certain time.
Now, that explains something. I, for instance, have some radio transcriptions of George Gershwin on the air.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he's playing himself. It sounds like he's reading the part George Gershwin. It sounds very scripted.
Absolutely, yeah. And the person who broke that down was Mary Margaret McBride. And she was doing book interviews with authors on a local station. I think it was on WOR in New York. And it was all ad lib, and she insisted on doing it that way. And it was really the most successful book program. And as a result of her success, she was brought over to one of the networks, NBC or ABC, and then she was allowed to continue doing it because she was Mary Margaret McBride. And then other people began to realize that this whole thing had been ridiculous. So, yes, but in the early years, they were so afraid that somebody would say something that would somehow change the course of history. There were, for instance, an opera singer who was allowed to go on the air, and the agency, the station had been warned against her because she does surprising things. But she said she only wanted to read some nursery rhymes. So they felt reassured, and she did read some nursery rhymes. And one of them was, there was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children because she didn't know what to do. And this caused an absolute catastrophe at the network. I mean, the station, they had, you know, she was persona non grata from then on. So that's the kind of thing that they were afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't think anything happened in the way of terrible things, but they were very much afraid of that, and the whole the thing had been sold before radio began to get so commercial. It had been sold as this enormous educational opportunity. I mean, the rhetoric in the early 20s about what radio would do and how it would change the world and how this was the opportunity for democracy to really prove itself.
Boy, does that sound familiar.
Oh, yes.
Every time a new medium comes along, we fool ourselves into thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
About how we will become perfected.
Yeah, the predictions of 1922, I think I called it the euphoria of 1922 in the history book I did, was just marvelous. There was even a former Secretary of the Navy who said nobody is now afraid that the Japanese will ever bomb up Pacific possessions because radio makes secrecy impossible.
Wow. So tell me, every time you hear predictions about how cable will change our lives or digital or the internet, the World Wide Web, do you go, oh, sure, I've heard this before?
I do. I don't even have to tell myself that anymore. Yes. Yes, I have a built-in resistance to it.
Eric Barno, his new memoir is called Media Marathon.